The Home Show with Sinead Ryan. This is News Talk.
This is Sinead Ryan from The Home Show. Now, unfortunately, I can't be with you in studio this week because I'm self-isolating at home due to the coronavirus. But we've just celebrated our first birthday on air, so I thought it would be a good opportunity to look back at some of our best bits. You can download all episodes of The Home Show on newstalk.com or wherever you get your podcast content. I hope to be in studio with you again next week. You're very welcome along to The Home Show. This is Sinead Ryan with you on News Talk's programme and podcast, where we look at all areas of the home, from design, architecture to interiors and everything which affects the way we live today. You can contact the programme by emailing thehomeshow@newstalk.com, and you can find me on Twitter at Sinead_Ryan. I'm joined by Rory Hearn, author and lecturer in social policy at Maynooth University. Rory, you're very welcome to The Home Show and thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Sinead. Thanks for having me.
Now, we're running a series across on News Talk all called Home Truths, and it's focusing on different aspects of housing and looking a lot of the way other countries do things, maybe a little bit better than we do, and what models could work best and how we compare. What are your main home truths when it comes to housing policy? What are we doing well and what are we doing not so well?
Okay, well, I think that it's quite clear that there's a lot of problems with housing policy. We only have to look at the crisis. You know, is highlighting, you know, the different people who have been excluded. We look at homelessness in terms of, you know, particularly new families who have become homeless. We look at those excluded, what we call the locked out generation rent. And increasingly, you know, new groups all the time, you know, people who are becoming older in terms of pensioners stuck in the private rented sector, you know, in terms of being able to afford housing accommodation. And the housing crisis is kind of been portrayed as one of an issue of like this lack of supply and this housing shortage problem. But it's much more than that, because if we look at it, you know, and I've been analysing this for a number of years and pointing out that at the core, it has been, we had a model of building housing in Ireland from kind of the mid-1990s onwards, which was really around lending to home purchase and a development build model built around that. And then increasingly towards the mid-90s and into 2000s, there was a big kind of buy-to-let aspect to that. So a lot of people were investing in a house as a pension or for their child or an asset, kind of what we might call. And of course, what happened with a parallel to that in the 90s and 2000s was the whole area of social housing was kind of looked on as something that really wasn't needed anymore. And I kind of describe this in the most simplistic way possible, that essentially the state, government and departments, housing departments, saw social housing as something that the kind of local authorities wouldn't do anymore. And they saw that really housing, kind of home ownership, was going to be the main way, you know, people would access their housing. Housing would be built by the private developers and private market, and there was no real need for the state. And this was a really short-sighted policy. And I think at the heart, that's why we're in the crisis. We are one of the reasons we're in the crisis we're in.
So do you think there was a kind of a conflation of home ownership and housing as the same thing? Because all the social housing that was built in this country, it seems to me, the whole bulk of it was built in the 60s, in the 70s, maybe the very early 80s. And as you say, we kind of went off on a different path. And do you think the policy was, if we can enable everybody to buy a home or as many people as possible, then we can cut back on social housing and we don't need to build it anymore?
Yeah, and it was deemed that social housing had failed, essentially, that there was a number of areas that were pointed to, like Ballymun, for example.
It was ghettoised.
Was ghettoised, and this notion that, you know, social housing, and it did become reduced to just the very low income. And we didn't develop a housing system like they have in Denmark or Austria, where social housing was available for any income,
really. Or like a public housing model.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, we mentioned that. We had Lorcan Sir in, actually, last week, if anybody wants to listen to the podcast of the show. And he was talking about the strength of that public housing model, which we don't do here. We have social housing for one segment of society and then private for everybody else.
Yeah,
you're a fan of that too?
Yeah, I think the idea we have to, I think that's the big shift we have to make, is to this idea of the state building, the state plus housing associations, plus local authorities, plus cooperatives building housing, not just for those who are in a very low income, which social housing, who are on the waiting list, but for middle income people. And really, like in countries like Denmark and in cities like Vienna, anybody can access what we call public housing. And because then you basically create a mix of incomes in it. And this is the problem that we've got to now, is the reality is that at least a third of people can't afford housing costs in Ireland. They can't afford it. And that's not going to change. And so the question is, well, who is going to build them housing? How are they going to access housing? And we have to make the shift, I think, for the state to say, actually, it's our responsibility, not just to build it all, but to ensure there is housing associations. And I think there is a need to set up a housing agency, a home building agency.
I mean, no,
we have a land development agency and we have a housing agency. But their remit is not to go out and ensure the building of, for example, 20,000 affordable units per year, to coordinate with local authorities, with housing associations.
No, but isn't their job, and aren't they doing it to some extent, building affordable housing? Now, I'm sure you would say, and most people would agree with you, not enough and not quickly enough, but there is that affordable housing model. We're giving cheap loans to people, the house prices are being kept under control, and it is exactly for people who maybe just miss out on social housing but cannot afford fully private mortgages.
But this is the problem, you see. The house prices in Dublin, for example, and in other cities, and you know, are way beyond the reach, even if they stopped increasing, are way beyond the reach of the average income worker.
Well,
the
architects
average
will say
family.
That's to do. Developers will say that's down to the building cost. Nothing we can do about it. That's the price of land.
And this is the point I would make, that our model, our housing system, is over-reliant on that private developer model, which can only provide what will cover profit, what will cover the costs, whereas the state can do it much, much cheaper because it has the land, it can access cheaper finance, it can do, you know, the economies of scale and build housing. And we know this, like it can, the figure for building a house, a 3-bedroom house by the state is 200,000 versus the private market, it could be 300, 500, 600,000. But the point being that the state has state housing policy turned to, on the one hand, stop building social housing, but the other hand, it turned to the private rental sector through the housing assistance payment scheme, the rental accommodation scheme to get social housing. So we now have this crazy situation where a third of all private tenancies are paid by the state under various schemes, a third of them. So you have almost a billion a year going into private landlords, private house companies to access housing. That is money that's lost by the state. That could be building affordable homes, social homes that are permanently there. And I think there's a real reluctance on the part of the state and government to actually say, hang on a minute, our current approach to housing policy doesn't work. We need the state to be building not just social housing, but affordable housing, affordable rental housing, the public rental like they do have in other European countries.
Now, I've my own cynical view on this as to why they're not building it. I'm going to ask you for your expert view, which is probably more valid. But I have a sense, of course, the government doesn't only have one agenda. It has several that it has to hit. And one of those is trying to get the bank solvent for resale and get people out of negative equity, because you don't sell a state bank when it has big problems on its loan books. So do you think that there was a deliberate contraction in supply, in deliberately not building the houses that were needed in order that demand would just push up the price of what was there? Because the reports now out from the Department of Housing and the Central Bank is that nobody will be in negative equity by the middle of next year. Problem solved. I mean, isn't that a great thing to have achieved, even if the byproduct is we now have this contraction?
Yeah, I think you're actually right that the housing policies in many ways have also been determined by wider economic policies. So in terms of our, and I've written about this as well, that our response to the crash, the property crash in 2008 and the banking crash, was how do we save the financial institutions? And everything was about saving the financial institutions. So we set up NAMA. What did NAMA do? NAMA went and tried to flog all the assets, all the land it could, as quickly as possible. And we went out and tried to bring in big property investors, big global investors who are interested in speculating, in finance, speculating in land, speculating in property, to buy up these toxic loans off the banks. And absolutely central to that was reinflating the property market and rental market. And when I and others were shouting in 2015, 16, 17, rents are increasing, there needs to be some policy. We know part of the reason why rents were not cooled down is because they did see this as a positive development in in terms of the value of buy-to-let properties, the mortgage arrears crisis. But I think it was a major policy mistake. There could have been other ways of addressing that whole issue. And the notion that, and there is an issue that who is the government governing for? Because there is a small group of people who do benefit from the rising property market. But generation, the younger generations don't benefit. You know, and people know, even people who are benefiting, sitting in a home, watching a rising value, where are their children going to get housing? And we've conflated this notion that somehow rising property prices are a great thing. They're not actually. They're actually very bad in terms of
It might be bad for society, but if you're sitting in a house and you're watching its asset rise, and that's where, you know, half of all our wealth in Ireland is contained in property for each individual, it's a good thing.
But you see, people can see it is a good thing for a certain amount of people. And I would argue it's a minority. Because as I said, you could be sitting in your house worth 500,000, maybe 500,000. Where are your children going to buy a house? Where are they going to rent a house? And I think there is increasing realization that our current, you know, obsession with seeing house as an asset, as a commodity, as a wealth investment is actually, you know, it's dysfunctional. That doesn't actually serve society. It absolutely serves the very wealthy investors. And we're seeing them coming in here now, the so-called cuckoo funds, buying up significant property.
Okay, I'm speaking with Dr. Rory Hearn, a lecturer in social policy in Maynooth. Rory, you have been advocating that housing, or the right to housing, should be enshrined in our constitution. What would that mean, apart from another dreaded referendum?
Well, I think that the part of the problem, if you look and you analyse what has been our problem with housing over the last 30 years, maybe almost 40 years since the 1980s, was this big shift to in policy in viewing housing essentially as this asset or this place where people invest their money into. It's a wealth accumulating asset, rather than the notion of what is housing. It's a home. That's what it is for people. It's a place where they can feel safe. It's a place where they can raise their children. It's a place where they can, or what it should be, is a place where they can feel safe in a community and be nurtured in a community. What do we have now in Ireland? We have at least half a million people, at least a third of all households who are either in some form of mortgage distress, are on social housing waiting lists, are in rental insecurity where they can't put a picture on the wall. They don't know if they're going to be living there in 6 months' time or a year's time. So there's something fundamentally wrong in how we look at housing and we treat housing. And I think that, and not just me, but the UN, the United Nations, and, you know, housing policy people around the world and in the countries where they do housing best, they treat housing as a human right or as a social good. So the primary function of housing, of apartments, is that people can have their housing needs met.
Yeah, but we have an anomalous situation in Ireland. 92% of landlords in Ireland are of the amateur variety. The guy who owns the house next door for his pension. That it does not pertain in other European countries, where you have professional landlords, you have funds who are prepared to take the profit over 30 or 40 years. And these are the so-called maybe cuckoo funds. Maybe they're hitting a segment of society, you know, that is top end rather than what we want to address, which is at the lower end. But they do have a role. Surely that is one of the solutions and the way forward. Maybe if we had better protections for tenants.
Yeah, we absolutely do need better protections for tenants. We need tenants to be able to, you know, have lifetime tenancies. We need protection from evictions. I think there should be a moratorium on evictions, actually, for a period of time at the moment with the level of homelessness that's going on. But the problem is, it has been said, like, government ministers have stood up in the Dáil and said, we can't, or we're reluctant to impose or put in place greater regulatory, longer lifetime tenancies, tenancy support, because the constitution, it might impact on the constitutional right to private property, which is set out in Article 43. So therefore the question is, well, if the constitution is stopping us from putting in place protections for tenants to be able to live in a home, then surely it needs to change. And I think that the problem is in housing policy, there's no guiding value, there's no guiding framework. Surely it should be a basic thing that alongside the right to private property is a balancing right, which is the right to a home, the right to affordable, adequate, secure home. That doesn't mean everybody gets a home. What it means is that it's the state's responsibility to ensure everybody has access to that. And when we look at homelessness, there is no end in sight to increasing homelessness. At what point do we say as a society, this is wrong?
OK. Rory Hearn, thank you very much. Very interesting insights there. Host of the Reboot Republic and lecturer in social policy at Maynooth University. Thanks for being on The Home Show.
Thanks so much for having me, Sinead.
You're listening to The Home Show on News Talk with me, Sinead Ryan. Now, you may recognise my next guest from her work on Room to Improve, managing the expectations and demands of clients and builders, not to mention Dermot Bannon. And it's not an easy job. Patricia Power, quantity surveyor and project manager. Thanks for joining us on the show.
Not at all, Sinead. Thank you.
Now, you are a QS, a quantity surveyor. And I think there are loads of people out there who are not quite sure what that is. They can understand an architect. They certainly know what a builder does. Tell us a bit about the nuance of your particular profession.
Okay. What I do, and you're 100% right, does get confused. I have people who would approach me in the street or send me emails and say, can you do the design for me? And I actually go, no, it's not what I do.
You don't draw the pictures
no,
and you don't put the bricks on the mortar.
I don't draw the pictures. I'm not the engineer. I'm not the architect. But if you want to do an extension or if you want to do a new build or you want to do a refurb to your existing house, I'm the person to go to tell you how much it's going to be. I'm the independent person who is the professional who will work up the cost based on the drawing that's been done by the architect, and if you have a drawing from an engineer, to tell you this is going to cost you X amount, maybe we'll say 300 grand. And if you come to me and you say, listen, Patricia, it's going to cost 300, my budget was 200, I'm the person then that will sit down with you and the architect and the engineer and look at the options where we can tailor it back to suit your budget. Because obviously there's no point in having a drawing and going to the next stage, whether it be planning or going to tender to obtain a builder, if you can't afford to build it. Okay, so what I always say to people is, I suppose in summary, what I say to people is I'm like an accountant, but my area of expertise is construction and building and building cost. That's where I work. You know, that's my bread and butter. And so I'm here to tell you from an independent point of view what the current market rates are and what's going to cost you to do the work that you want to do.
Okay, and I mean, that's important because, well, you're a woman after my own heart now, involved in the money side. I'm all for that on any job. But actually, for most people, of course, building an extension or you know, a big project like that, maybe just something they do once in their life.
Yeah.
So they don't know how much the going rate is for different things, what they should be paying for things. Maybe they've an inflated or deflated view of what those giant big windows actually, you know,
do
come
cost.
In at. Yeah. So bring us through the process then. Now, I know that when we do see those big projects and grand designs on the telly, we always see, you know, they've gone out to tender and there's companies vying for the business and all that. But if you're just putting a kind of a new kitchen on or something, how is it important to go out to tender? What's the price point where that then becomes a thing?
Yeah, no, I think it's always important to go to tender. And tender can be, you know, going to tree builders or can be a lot more formal where you do a full bill of quantities. And that's what a QS will do. And at tender stage, which is like, it's like a book, like a Bible, sometimes I call it, of a description of the works that are involved in doing your extension, say for and that will list out all the materials that the builder is to price, and it will list out set items that for the client to go pick during the during the build period, which might be allowance for your kitchen of 10 grand, an allowance for your utility units of 3, or maybe allowances for floor finishes. So that allows the client set the standard of those items. They go into the bill of quantities, which goes out to each of the builders to price, and it just gives the client control. So that's what it does in the standard of those items. And then the builder gets to price their items, which would be general block, plastering, render, timber work, roof work, you know. Which
so is part of your job then early, at the very early stage, saying to clients, don't forget this and you need to include that, and what about this, where they might be only thinking about the sofa they're going to get in afterwards.
Absolutely. Like at the very early stages, what I would always say to people I'd recommend is, once you have engaged an architect and you have a plan that you're happy with and maybe some elevation sketch stage even, come to me, come to a QS, and that's the time to put the costings on paper, and they will cost everything. Like my jobs are literally turnkey. You can walk in, live in your house, the floor finishes are done, the curtain's done, it's painted, the utility units are in, your kitchen units are in, everything is done and complete, bar, curtains, alarm, loose furniture,
the
certain
nice
items are few,
yeah,
fit okay. furniture, so it's practical, you can live in your house. I've a lot of people who sometimes will go to a builder and say, listen, give me a price, I want to do this. It's a builder's price. It does include those finishing items, which are a substantial amount of the cost.
No, because you don't want wires sticking out of walls and skirting boards hanging off because, oh, you didn't include that in the price.
Yes.
Do you find that, you know, if you're getting a job done for somebody, that the the builders, the professionals take it more seriously if there's somebody like a QS standing there watching what they're doing?
They do. No, absolutely. They do. And I suppose what I find with a lot of builders is they will actually like to work with a QS because it's a lot more organised. They're talking their language. It's probably bringing the business element into the construction sector, which is kind of a rarity. You know, the architect's there, they do the design, their skill. The engineer is there to make the structure stand. And then the QS will bring in the business element and the cost element and the financial element, which is super, super important. Like, as you mentioned earlier, this is a massive outlay for any client after the purchase price of a house. If they're doing a refurb or do a upper or doing an extension, it's a large amount of money. So you want to spend it right and spend it wisely. And that's where a QS will guide you from start to finish, from the initial costings to make sure the plans are right and you're not overstepping your budget. You know, you're within your budget, you're comfortable, you're not going outside your parameters, to guide you through the tender stage, to advise on selection of different contractors, to do the bill of quantities. So it goes out clear in black and white what the builders have to price.
But do you think that, is it sometimes the case, because that's what we see on the telly, that actually it's the client themselves is their own worst enemy? Because they say, oh, I didn't know it was going to look like that. Let's double that over here. Or let's put them over here. Can we have another one of these or a bigger window or whatever?
Yeah, there can be a certain amount of that. Like, to be fair, I'm looking at drawings for 20 odd years, so I can visualise it. I can see what the architect has done and what he's put in the plans. I can see the impact of the steel and where it's going by the engineer and the frame and how it's going to work. To be fair to a client who's never looked at a drawing before,
it's hard.
It's on paper.
You need spatial skills just to be able to be in it.
Absolutely. And even on paper, you see a room and it might be 7 metres by 5, which is quite substantial, but they just can't visualise that. It still looks small to them because they're looking at it on a drawing, on a page. Yeah. So until it's actually built and the shell is there and they walk into a room, it's very hard to get that feeling. And even it's kind of can be very confusing. Even when the shell is up and it's grey, it's wet, it's dirty blockwork,
you can't see the furniture, the low lighting, the rugs.
It always looks smaller until it's finished and painted. That room will look much bigger. It's amazing. It's deceiving.
Do you always have to include overruns, contingencies, the stuff that you kind of know in your heart and soul there's something going to go wrong here?
I would always recommend a contingency sum is put in. Yes, absolutely. Now, I would always kind of, I suppose, with experience, you kind of know the risk factors, you know the elements that might be a concern. And like, if in a new extension, those elements are digging the foundations, digging the ground, because you don't know what you're going to find.
Yeah.
An existing house, I'd always be worried because you're opening up, pulling down walls,
roofs,
what you could discover underneath. So when you get past a certain stage, a lot of those worry and risk items will have diminished. So then if you haven't eaten into your contingency, I would always say to the client, listen, we're safe enough now. There's a little bit of money. If you want to spend a bit more in your kitchen or your tiles, now's the time to do it. But it's guiding. What I do is I guide people through the process. It's nearly like I say, I hold their hand and I direct them.
And
you know,
need it. Now, we know from the likes of Room to Improve that, you know, there's a huge amount of drama. I know we suspect it's edited and only the weirdos are picked out, but actually, are most projects like that?
Every project is different. It's amazing. People come to me and say, well, you did that house for that. But every house is different. Every project, every client is different.
You get husbands and wives fighting with each other.
You can quietly. And then you get dragged in. What do you think, Patricia? But most are good and they will discuss it before we meet or after we meet. You know, but you have to be diplomatic and
a family mediator.
Sometimes it takes a little bit of time to go through that process and come around. But I will always give the best advice possible based on my experience, and I'm not going to guide you wrong. I'm going to tell you what I believe is the right thing to do, whether you take that on board or not. And in a lot of situations I will say to them, because I get constantly asked, what do you think of this design? Like, you've employed an architect for a reason. They're professional, they're very good at what they do. Listen to them.
You have to trust them. Alright, well, listen, Patricia Power, quantity surveyor and project manager, thank you for being with us today on The Home Show.
Thank you, Sinead.
We have our resident architect and designer joining us again. Roisin Murphy, you're very welcome to studio.
Lovely to see you, Sinead, as always.
Now, you were at a conference recently, and I know that you are, you know, architect, championing the female cause. maybe also all on your own. But you were at a conference which was looking at women in architecture.
Yes,
and women
we're celebrating women in architecture.
Okay,
really.
So what are we celebrating? There are loads of women architects. They're so creative. They're wonderful at design.
This was in Grange Gorman in the new TUD campus, yeah. And we had
they don't like that technological university of Dublin.
Can we change that?
Because
I'm doing
a
lecture down there.
Go
okay,
ahead.
Technological University Dublin, and they had Grafton Architects, Hennigan Penn Architects, McCullough Mulvan Architects, Fitzgerald Cavanagh Architects, and O'Donnell and Toomey Architects, which all have women in their midst and women designers and either partners or Grafton Architects, which is two female leads who have founded the business. So, because it was kind of interesting, because it's a very male-dominated...
Is it?
Well, there was only six girls when I went to college in the class of 30. And it was kind of scary as well, because you were then in a technological university which had an awful lot of male apprentices. You know, it was that kind of environment. I don't want to gender be specific about what people should study, but there was a lot of blokes there. I'll put it like that.
Okay. And now?
I don't know what the stats are now, but I know that when we went up to this conference, first of all, Colette Burns, who'd organised it from Grange Gorman, who very kindly invited me along and who spoke very passionately about women representation. And she had women project architects there as well. It wasn't just designers. So that was really interesting. But she was saying, oh, well, Roisin, I don't know what it'll be like, you know, whether it'll be half full. Apparently we're going to get 100 people in. It was full. There was lots of people who were excited and interested to talk about women in architecture and to look at their projects.
So what do women bring specifically to the architectural community that people don't bring, you know? I mean, I'm always kind of a little bit nervous about doing items where it shouldn't be a topic.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be anything.
I know, it shouldn't be, but it sort of is. And you know, women get a tough time in the construction industry. I didn't find it particularly easy. And I still find it quite difficult that sometimes when you're talking, say, engineering, structure, construction, walls coming down, there is the notion that you mightn't really know what you're talking about.
So not being taken seriously.
Well, yeah. Not being taken seriously.
You're fine with the designery, coloury stuff, but not with the
But you mightn't know anything structural like. Mightn't really like. I mean, we've had it. And I'd be bold and say I've had it on the programme where my lovely partner in crime, Pete the Builder, well, I'd be like going, okay, just, yeah, right, we are taking that wall down. And I'll be quietly sitting there and say, yeah, the wall's going to come down. Yeah, and thinking that wall is definitely coming and does come down. But you'll have to bite your tongue and kind of go, right, okay, I have to pretend now I don't really have 7 years under my belt, worked on sites all over the country. And, you know, even taking down a few walls in my own house with my own hammer and lump hammer. That's just hard work. But back to the conference. The conference was, what I found really interesting was they explained each of the projects and talked about Grange Gorman, which is a game changer for the North Side to a certain extent. So it was very interesting to see how they had integrated all these different architects into this master plan. Because if you think about forming a new, there's two serious radical universities happening in the inner city. One is DCU, which is going right across, say, up the scientific corridor, they're calling it, up the other end of the main Drumcondra Road. It's crossing from Collins's Avenue all the way along, and we're getting new transport up there. But then on the other side towards the river, there's going to be basically a walkway right down as far as the river through Grange Gorman. So it's a huge environmental impact, bringing pollinators, the new term at the moment, pollination from linking that up, that green corridor, which is extraordinary.
Long needed.
And so they talked about that. That was very interesting. And then I suppose one of the projects that really resonated with me was the Grafton Architects one, because they're doing an Educate Together school, and it's on a very tight, constricted site. So they have designed it all around a stairwell.
Interesting. So how does that work? That becomes the focal point, and then everything else
derives
from it.
Yeah, it was really interesting, because you're there going, oh my God, in light of, say, so many schools are now talking about the problem, I'm going to bring it back to homelessness, but kids living in hubs, kids living in hotels, but the importance of architecture. And when you come to school, you know, you may have been living in a hotel room. So the importance of school buildings in our story about educating our children. And I was sitting there going, wow, because you know the way, if you say have dyspraxia or something like that, a staircase is actually a really important educational tool. One, to establish if a kid has it, because you can see how they walk up and down a stair. So if you have kids in prefabs in poor quality, poor design buildings, and then they're going to hotel rooms, there's not that opportunity for them to learn through movement, but also there's not the opportunity to observe kids and say, well, that child has difficulty. That, you know, they can't negotiate a staircase properly.
And I suppose there's that element of designing around people who are invariably going to be a lot shorter than the designer. You know, small people.
Yes.
And
yes.
We have maybe... You know, door handles need to be lower and light switches need to be lower.
And they did a lovely thing as well where it was designed around animals. So they had things like giraffes and stuff. So I thought that there was a lot of other projects which were integrating colour for the first time. I got quite excited. I can't be sure about this, but I could have sworn on one of the buildings featured there was a pink render. Which, you know, we are really conservative about colour in buildings in Ireland. Yeah. There's a nursery building in France, which I'll put up on my Instagram later, where they have a pink floor outside undercroft of the building. It's all done in pink.
Although, of course, I'm having a flashback now to my convent school walls, which were gloss beige. Moving to glass green in the bathroom. Mm-hmm. So we weren't always terrible with colour. They were just terrible colours.
No, but this is outside, Sinead. This is an actual, you are right though, because we used to have it in West Cork, we would build and paint things very brightly. But I do think the proliferation of kind of modern architecture is a bit dull. There's a little bit of lots of brick, lots of glass and very little colour on the outside of buildings in Ireland.
You're still suffering from your home farm dressing room.
I am. And the blue and white stripes. I'm still convinced by that. But the stripes stayed though. The hoop stayed.
Okay. Yeah, very good. Okay, we can't get away from bathrooms on this show. I'd say we get more questions in on bathrooms than pretty much anything else. So we said we'd turn our hand to some of the listeners' questions that have come in regarding bathrooms. And hopefully you can put your practical hat on.
I'd just like to tell everybody I've been given no show and tell on these questions. So don't kill me if I get it wrong.
Confident you know all the answers. So our first question.
Let's get rid of Roisin in one episode.
Questioner, I have a tiny downstairs loo which I want to make a bit dramatic. What do you recommend, Roisin? Now, I am all for making downstairs loos a bit dramatic because they're a tiny space that you can go a bit mad in and nobody's going to come in and say you're a terrible kind of interior designer. What can you do to make very, very small space?
Very popular is funky wallpaper at the moment. That's a huge thing at the moment in downstairs bathrooms.
Now, wallpaper and bathrooms. So,
is it a bathroom or is it like a guest loo?
So, I'm thinking it must be a guest loo, just probably with a loo and a basin. But wallpaper and water, isn't that just a terrible no-no?
Well, it depends on if it's a vinyl. If it's done really correctly, it's fine. I mean, if they're put up properly. And you don't put them in the bathroom per se, in the shower room per se. You put them, but you are right. I have grown up with wallpaper in our bathroom as a kid, and it eventually would peel off. So it's difficult. But in a downstairs loo, underneath the staircase, it's an opportunity to splash colour, wallpapers. You know, people have done newspapers all over the walls there. It was a very popular thing. And I still think that's very fun. You know, to get a whole load of newspapers, particularly maybe of an era in which
you were born or something like that.
And put them up, it's lovely. Just things like that are fun. Yeah. I think a bathroom is an opportunity not to be too serious as well. You can also line it out completely in mirror. I think we've talked about that. Your horror of that.
No, that's a terrible idea. Who wants to see themselves perched on the loo?
Philippe started it in a coffee shop called Café Cosse years ago in Paris. And
I'm sure the Parisians don't mind seeing themselves on the
loo. No, because they only eat pee every day, so they're beautiful all the time from every angle. But we all went in as students to have a look at ourselves in the loo, and I couldn't find my way out. That's all I remember. Sure, there was somebody holding the door going, leave her in there. All the mirrors, yeah.
Well, what if you put the mirrors? So I'm thinking there might be a solution to put the mirror because I can get the feel of it and I think it sounds lovely. Maybe just put them just beyond eye level. Just lovely kind of gilt hanging mirrors or mirror tiles, but just where they can't see your wobbly bits.
Do you know what's really going guns at the moment as well is a kind of a brass wall finish. You know, it's like a panel of brass.
Oh, it's not like the back of a pub, no.
A How do you mean a pack of pump?
You know, with all that brass and...
No, it's like optics. A wall surface.
Yeah.
So it's very rich looking and...
I'm not seeing it.
You're not seeing it. Okay.
No. Okay. Well then, listener, be dramatic. Do what you like. It's a bit of fun. Another question. I love the idea of wallpaper in my bathroom. There you go. Is it a terrible idea and will appeal?
No, it's not a terrible idea.
So you're just saying
idea.
Pick your texture. So vinyl, but you're not talking about that.
Well, no, I'm saying pick quality newspapers. There's an ad for somebody. Pick
the Irish Independent.
Pick
to the FT all over your wall, your pink walls.
Pick a good wallpaper. Get into MRCB and meet. They have great wallpapers and they give really good advice. I can say that personally. They would be super for wallpapers. Also, Cloth do lovely wallpapers that are absolutely drop dead beautiful. I think we've had one of their samples in here before. So I'm all for wallpapers in bathrooms because I think it makes it look a bit posh.
And you can spend a bit of money because you're only going to need one roll. So
yeah, two maybe.
You?
But
you
really?
Get
a really good wallpaper could set you back a couple of hundred quid. One.
Yeah.
Yeah. But but to a certain extent, the bigger the print, the bolder the look. You know, it's a bathroom. Go for it.
Okay, be brave.
But a painting as well, nice big painting.
Right, the other way around. Now, the other side, okay. Family bathroom. I need loads of storage in my bathroom for all the kids, bath toys, lotions, towels and everything else, says a caller. It's looking really messy. Where can I put everything?
I know, I feel her pain.
I'm saying wait till the kids go.
Well,
in the bath.
Oddly enough, I asked somebody about this because that was my biggest bugbear was, you know, even the crayons, they'll give a crayon, is that you can get a sticky bag that goes inside your bath. So you have a suction cup and you put these draining sacks. So they basically all the toys
get holes in the bottom.
Yeah, like
you
mesh
put
bags.
Utensils in
yes,
for, okay.
Mesh bags. Oh, yeah. And so you basically treat it like that and put them in and as such treat it a little bit like a kitchen. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
so you put storage in and go with, and then I have also put into a bathroom a kind of salvaged old dresser or, you know, credenzas that you'd normally find in a dining room.
Yeah.
They're brilliant in a bathroom and look really funky.
Really?
And then you can.
And they're not going to warp now, right?
Well, mine hasn't. Okay. Mine hasn't.
No, because I mean, to be honest, in bathroom, I know, like I'm saying, oh, it's always wet and steamy, but it's not. It's wet and steamy for 10 minutes and then it's not.
Well, if it's properly ventilated with a window or ventilation, it really shouldn't be happening, in which case it's a whole other episode. But an old piece of furniture in a bathroom looks deadly, like really good. And you can put your towels, even glass fronted ones. So you can put towels in it and treat it like a shop. I have an old cabinet in mine and it drives everybody else nuts because they're like, what is that? And I said, place to put all the rubbish. And you can't, all you see is a cabinet.
Fabulous. So, and there's lots, of course, under sink storage units you can get. Wall mounted cabinets.
I'm very bad on the under sink storage for some reason.
Is it a bit old fashioned looking?
I don't know what it is. I always think it means hiding a horrible outlet. So I always get, they say, buy a nice sink, a really nice expressed sink. But I think that's just me. I've always done that for 30 years. You know, even when we were doing shops in Optica, we'd always get a stainless steel round sink to sit on the unit.
Texter in, I have gifted my husband our ensuite and taken the main upstairs bathroom for myself. I'm all for separate spaces, although I do have doubts over the cleaning that goes on in there, but it's not my problem anymore. I use candles as a tiny touch of luxury. For
nice.
Him, they're pure function. Oh, well, that's just ladies be men, isn't it,
that's
really?
That's the candles. You can't... We've had that in our book club, I think, where everybody's like, did you notice the candle?
Somebody else has texted in. Yeah. Sinks in toilet cubicles would cause more delay in busy women's public toilets.
Oh, yes, they would.
The main reason for the length of time it takes them versus men, texter, I think you're a boy, is that men use the facilities and leave. Yeah, but using the toilet is only the start of women's experience. You know a lot about this, texter. Give them their own sink and they'll stay twice as long.
Bitter pill in that house.
Okay.
Put a book magazine rack in there too.
Another element, since we're talking about damp and wet and surfaces and all
actually,
that.
Actually, before we go, back to that texter. My experience is that a lot of our gentlemen friends love to read in the bathroom. And we'll go in for
this
quite the read.
True. All the supplements.
All the supplements.
Plus their iPads.
Yeah, and now they go in with the phone. They're going, I'm going in with nothing. Why aren't you out yet? No. So it's not just ladies. Just to say, the gender balance would suggest that men like to read on
otherwise. Although some would say they're maybe just escaping duties or family life. And I'm all for that as well, by the way. I spent long enough when I remember as a new mother and I'm sure moms everywhere will remember this experience of the things they don't tell you in mom school when you're having a baby, that you are actually never going to be able to go into the bathroom alone for the first 3 years.
Oh my God. Oh, I know.
Never again. No. Forget it.
Yeah.
All your bodily functions will become a matter of interest for your children.
Or just, you know, just generally they're attached. So I remember finding that and somebody sending me my favorite baby present ever was one of those slings, you know, the Irish made slings, because whatever way they were attached, you could use your hands, because otherwise you got nothing done.
I know.
Just
baby goes everywhere. I remember with my first baby being so nervous of leaving her alone for like 1 second that her little chair would come into the loo.
I know.
The
only person who misses me now is the dog. It's like the only person who's like, you're back. Great.
But the joy that goes with locking the door and not having to worry about that is really sublime. So for new moms out there, it does change. So I can understand later on, when you have that time, bring in the candles, bring in the Prosecco, bring in the books, have the fluffy towels. Yeah. You know,
I'm with your sister, whoever you are. I am,
just a space for personal pleasure and enjoyment, even if all you're doing is having, you know, a quick shower. Okay, carpet versus wood. Now, we did have a question in on this, so I didn't add it into the bathrooms thing. But is carpet making a comeback? Like a serious comeback? The thick, deep pile. Stripped back wood and limed wood and all that was so fashionable for ages. And then people found it noisy and, you know, kind of clattering, especially people living in small spaces and upstairs, downstairs. Yeah. I love carpet. It's just me. I really love the feel of it, my bare feet on it. I love the look of it.
I know. And I always think of my mother-in-law with this when we sanded and varnished all the floors in the first house I went into. And my mother-in-law said, I just don't like it, Roisin. I said, how do you not like it? And she said, it reminds me of the old days where, you know,
you
couldn't afford a carpet. And we loved it. We had carpets everywhere. And they had literally, I don't know if you remember, they had carpets up the side of baths, back to bathrooms. But you remember that carpet used to go all the way up?
Yes. Wasn't a look.
It wasn't a look. I think the demise of carpets was related to the hypoallergenic thing. You have...
Everybody had an allergy. Okay.
You have hay fever. And there is a rise in those. There's nothing we can do about that. It seems to be on the rise, whether it's due to global warming or plastics or whatever it is. So... the carpet is very bad for that. So if you have a kid with hay fever, a kid with asthma, the first thing out of the house is the carpets. So
maybe
that's why I think...
better safe than sorry with mites and animals and all
so
that.
So for kids, I think then the compromise was big rugs and big, feature rugs are out and huge at the moment. But I think that there is, you can't deny the beautiful carpet either.
No, honestly, get rid of the kids. Seriously. Okay, right. I don't mean that. I mean, obviously, when they go naturally of their own accord after being booted out the door after 22 years.
Yeah, and this is where where everybody's going, bring back that co-living. I've children to get out of here.
Exactly.
What are you all on about, Mrs.?
Now, this week we come to our object of design.
Yes.
We've had some lovely pieces recently. So I can see you have, is it a picture coming out here?
This
I don't get these in advance. Advance notes
for
these folks.
An artist, Deirdre O'Reilly. And she is...
Oh, I know what that is. That's a tray.
No, well, not quite.
Okay.
Right, watch this.
Okay.
She does an awful lot of installations in schools. Okay.
So
she was in her
bed on that.
She was in her studio one day and she was looking at all these samples and she said, do you know what? I think I'm going to make a couple of these. And I just thought that was gorgeous. I loved it.
So it's a very, very low table
or
tray. I mean, I'm going to say tray because I can actually see how you would balance that. But it's just, so it's got a tiled surface.
These are all
textured.
They're all made by her.
Tiles are
beautiful.
These
are handmade tiles.
And I can feel them now. So you can feel the raised structures in this geometric design on the top of it, which is built into a beautiful wooden base with legs.
So you can
the legs are only maybe 8 inches
so
high.
What I like about this is it's a very chill vibe, if you know what I mean. You can imagine it in a garden when you're outside. You know, it's low to the ground, like for a couch. You know, when you don't want a table up here and you're sitting down and you want your book and your cup of coffee. But also it can be hung on a wall. So it's because her big thing would be installations in schools on walls and tiles. So what it is what I particularly like about this is that it's that real adaption that we're seeing in art, where an artist will decide, actually, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to just have a moment of doing, for instance, Mazur and his yoga mat, or here where your son are going to make a table out of it. That's a big sweeping thing in America, where there's some artists even making sweeping brushes, just a very small collection of applied art onto furniture. Yeah.
Lovely, and because these legs fold in underneath, yes, so it could be hung. So yeah, I can see that. Yeah. It's lovely. Okay, well, look, we'll put a picture up on Roisin Murphy Design, yes, on Instagram.
Yeah.
And as usual, on my Twitter feed, Sinead, yeah, at Sinead underscore Ryan.
Where are you, Sinead?
And on Newstalk. Okay. Roisin, thank you once again. You always delight us with these pieces. I'm not always great at interpreting them or even describing them. So go to have a look at the pictures, yes, of them, and showcasing as ever at the forefront of Irish design. Thank you
for
coming,
Sinead,
in again this week.
Thank you.
That's it for today's edition of The Home Show. My thanks to the production team, producer Rachel Ryan and Jojo Cardosa on sound. You can listen back to this and any other show on our podcast on the News Talk app or your podcast provider, and we'll chat to you next Saturday at 9 a.m.